This is an interview with David V. Johnson on August 2nd, 1985.
So do you want to start
continue
off
with that?
Or, yeah.
Well, I came here in 1947 as a graduate student. The reason I came is maybe immaterial, but I lost my job as a bureaucrat and had no immediate prospects for another job, and so we were in a federal agency, the National Labor Relations Board in Cincinnati, and another examiner lost his job at the same time, and he suggested we go to Wisconsin at summer school in labor economics with Salig Perlman, and so we did. And after summer school was over, I decided to stay and work for a master's degree. And then when I got my master's degree, I decided to go on for a PhD, and I stayed 2.5 years, got and with summer session attendance, got my residence in 2.5 years. And left and became a bureaucrat again for several years before I came back. At that time, my sponsor, I should say, since I was on the GI Bill, mm-hmm. and I had a wife and child, and it was rather difficult financially, and I say my sponsor, I met Edwin Young on the bus. I lived in Badger, which was 35 miles out, a veterans community. I say veterans community, there are also others living there. Ed was not a veteran, but at any rate, during the first semester I was here, I met him on the bus, and I explained what I had been doing and as a bureaucrat, as a labor examiner. And since he was teaching a course in labor problems, that interested him, and he offered me a job as his teaching assistant for the second semester, and I was glad to take that to supplement my income. So I was a teaching assistant for him and for Salig Perlman during the time that I was here. The income, however, was so small that I seized the first opportunity to get away from here. Having had a higher income before I came, I didn't like working for practically nothing, and so I went back to Washington the first time I was offered a job and left here. But during the time I was here, I guess this is prompted by our discussion of Edwin Young and Jim Early being presidents of the local AFT. The local AFT at that time was rather small, and of course there were no formal relations with the administration, although both Jim Early and Ed Young were able to get the ears of top administrators, and they were influential, and they also went downtown to the legislature, and while they didn't have any kind of collective bargaining status, they nevertheless, I think, had some influence on employment conditions for the faculty. And the union itself, like so many organizations right after the war, was torn between the left wing and the right wing. And in those days, it was the left wing, being those who were sympathetic with what was still, although they, I wouldn't say that they were communists, there was still a substantial communist movement in this country. And so any organization divided itself, and the teachers' union was among them, between those who considered themselves opposed to Harry Truman's policy of, in Greece and Turkey, and also opposed to NATO and things like that. And so a lot of our meetings were taken up with debate between the left wing and the right wing, and It was a very interesting time. The teaching assistants tended to be the left wingers, and but they were members of the union as well, and the faculty members tended to be considered the right wingers by the teaching assistants. But there's certain of us who, I don't know whether we were older, had different backgrounds, but we were considered right wingers by the among the teaching assistants. As well. At any rate, at that time, Edwin Witte was chairman of the department, and he had been chairman, I think, during a period somewhat before the war, and then after the war. He was gone during the war in Washington. After I left in 1950, Edwin Young became chairman, I think, in 1952 or 53, and continued until 1961. We'd have been happy to continue him on farther, but he became dean, and Bob Lamon was chairman for a year, and then Jim Rowley established a new tradition. The old tradition had been that anyone who could be agreed upon by a, I think, rather divisive faculty could be chairman and continue to be chairman. Jim Rowley decided that it ought to be something that was passed around, and he declared that he was establishing a new tradition of 3-year chairmanship. And so I continued that. He was chairman from 62 to 65, and I was chairman 65 to 68, and that has continued ever since. There was another tradition, I think, that was, I don't know whether you'd say unspoken or whether it just arose because of the circumstances, but all the chairmen, I think, with the possible exception of Kiko, for when he may have been chairman, were PhDs from this department up until my termination. Jerry Summers was the first, in my memory at least, the first non-Wisconsin PhD. And up until, I suppose if you include Lee Hansen as one of the labor people, with the exception of Jim Rowley, all the chairmen had been labor people up through Summers, and if you include Lee Hansen as being divided between labor and public finance, why, they'd all been labor. Then that tradition terminated.
Well, I noticed a couple of places you were listed being associate chair for a couple of years before.
That's right. In Jim Rowley's chairmanship, I was the associate. That was a new position. There never been.
Has it ever existed?
It had never existed. And Bob Lampman, during his chairmanship in 61-62, solicited candidates in the department, and I told him that I'd be willing to do it, and apparently, probably because I was the only one who told him was willing to do it, he suggested me to Early when Early became chairman, and so I was associate chairman. During my incumbency as associate chairman, I think probably people may have been not completely satisfied with the amount of attention that was being given to undergraduate education, and mm-hmm. so we decided to recruit for an undergraduate chairman rather than an associate chairman in 1965. I don't know whether he came in 64 or 63, but we recruited Ralph Andriano to be the undergraduate chairman. And then when I became chairman, there was no associate chairman, but there was an undergraduate chairman who was Ralph. And he continued in that job, I think, until through the Summers chairmanship, possibly past that, I'm not sure. But at that time, It was in the early 60s or middle 60s, we thought that we ought to give more attention to undergraduate education. At that time, we didn't have too many undergraduate majors. I think somewhere in the vicinity of 200 or 300. In the 60s, of course, the popularity of different departments changes. In the 60s, it was clearly history was the most popular undergraduate major. And I think political science probably was more popular than economics. Since that time, I think we've become one of the biggest undergraduate departments in the College of Letters and Science. And partly that's can be attributed to all the efforts that Ralph Andriano made to improve our, not just our offerings, but our teaching, and of course Lee Hansen has contributed tremendously to that goal or objective. And I think we now are considered one of the best departments in, as far as undergraduate teaching is concerned. And it was, I think it was not true in earlier years, although you'll hear stories about Wild Bill Kiekhofer and his teaching. He had the strange reputation of being know-nothing as far as graduate students were concerned, but being a great teacher and economist as far as undergrads are concerned. If you go out in the state and see people who were here in the 30s and 40s and 50s who did not go on to graduate work, he's the thing they remember about the department, and yet he was a person that was scorned by the graduate students, and they had to use his textbook as teaching assistants because he always used it. Mm-hmm. I never heard any questions raised about what he did with all the royalties that he got out of that, as we have been hearing more recently when people use their own textbooks. I don't know, it just didn't seem to come up. But he always used his own textbook, and the TAs, I think, majority of them thought it was out of date and it didn't have enough Keynesian material in it. Mm-hmm. And, he was very popular. Mm-hmm. Well, what else can I say?
Well, what did you do as associate chair? That was a kind of briefly a position.
Well, I had to, in those days, up until Jim Rowley became chairman, the admissions was handled by the chairman. That is, Ed Young will tell you that he did it rather casually on the side, along with many other duties that he had. So I became the chairman of the admissions committee and the person who decided who would get the teaching assistantships, and handled the business of assembling the materials for the competition and the graduate school for the fellowships that we had. Of course, this was a transitional period in the sense that it had not been much before that, maybe almost simultaneously, that the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation was pressured by Fred Harvey Harrington and Edwin Young and a few other social scientists into releasing or granting money to social scientists. You see, that money had all been accumulated from Harry Steenbach's vitamin D patent and I suppose from the warfarin discovery and patent. And all those royalties, and so the physical scientists had kept all that money to themselves up until Fred Harrington, who was a very assertive person, along with Edwin Young's assistants, I'm sure, and others whose names I've forgotten or maybe never knew, pressured the wharf into using some of that money for social scientists, not only for faculty, but for graduate students fellowships. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, the paperwork required increased, and so it was something that the chairman presumably didn't have enough time to do, but it was not too much for an associate chairman to do. So I did that kind of thing. And I also, at that time, was on the building committee. As far as building is concerned, you know, we moved over here in 1962 from Sterling Hall, mm-hmm. where we had occupied one floor, the third floor. The Commerce School was on the fourth floor. Physics was on floors one and two. And we felt that the expansion here was tremendous. So we moved into this building, and we had tremendous amount of space that we had not had before, and we were expanding more rapidly than the sociology department and the anthropology department. So we got the biggest part of the space in this building. But this is a period of rapid expansion of the faculty from all during the 1960s. And after we had moved in the building, we'd been here a couple of years, the building started to be too small. And that's when Guy Orchid, they ought to call this part of the building Orchid Hall. He was instrumental in getting the money from the National Science Foundation, the matching money to build this part of the building, and it was opened, I think, in the first year of my chairmanship in 65, and we took over a substantial part of this. Long about the time that Jerry Summers was chairman, the sociology department had expanded enough so they started taking space away from us. And they, it was traumatic for us to lose the space to them on the seventh floor in the front of the building. They've taken some of that, or they took it at that time, and mm-hmm. they took more of it here and there. Yes. But we were expanding very rapidly during those days, and it's amazing that we could have somehow been fitted into the third floor of Sterling Hall ever. But I guess when I came in 1957, I believe there were probably about, 20, 25 faculty members. By the time I ceased being chairman in 1968, we had somewhere between 40 and 45. After that, in the early 70s, I guess Lee Hansen suffered more than anybody as chairman. There was a freeze, and we didn't get any people, and I think we went down perhaps to 35. I think we're a little higher than that now, somewhere around 35, between 35 and 40. Perhaps, but those were those years in the 60s, up I guess the decade of the 60s, were a period when it was really, I suppose, in retrospect, a delight to be an administrator in this university. The numbers of students were expanding, and the financing of the university was partly on a kind of a per capita basis from fees, and the expenditures didn't keep up with the income, and so our relationships with the dean weren't perfect. We would go to the dean and say we would like to expand with so many people, and the dean more than likely would say okay and give us the authority to do it. And that was true generally during the early chairmanship and in my chairmanship. I used to joke with Ed Young about how when he was dean, we didn't have as good a relationship because for reasons of his own, being a member of the department, he may not have treated us as well as he was treated other departments, and I say we were very fortunate in my chairmanship. In the beginning of my chairmanship, he told me that he was leaving to be president of the University of Maine, which I couldn't believe at first. I just didn't believe that he would do that. But then we got Leon Epstein as dean, and I've always told Ed Young that Leon treated us much better than Edwin Young ever did. And I guess if you talk to Leon Epstein, he would tell you that he was dean at the perfect time. More money than he knew what to do with. And I guess there's another element in here that I'm forgetting. But as far as finances were concerned, he was dean at a great time. Then he resigned about 1971, about the same time that the amount of money declined. Steve Klaney became dean just about, I think, the same time that Lee Hansen became chairman, and Lee was presented with a freeze on recruitment for practically a whole time he was chairman, I think. Didn't get anything. We had, presumably, from the standpoint of the dean, we had overexpanded in our recruitment. And I'm very proud of some of the people that we recruited during that period, although I was embarrassed at the loss of two of our most distinguished people while I was chairman. Guy Orchard left. He was here, I mean, he left about the same time I ceased being chairman. And Arnold Zellner left during my chairmanship. I don't know that there was anything that I could have done to keep them. I guess saying something about Guy, I should say a little about what he did for this department. I think he was greatly instrumental in making the department what it is today and really improving it tremendously. We have to give credit to Ed Young, of course, for recruiting Guy, who was a completely different kind of a person than Ed, and different from anything that we'd had in the department up until that time. Guy came, I think he came in 58, didn't he? I came in 57, same year that Steiner and Summers came. And Lampman came in 58, and Orchard. I think Goldberger was recruited by Orchard and came in 59, although he might have come in 58. But Guy established the SSRI as soon as he came, and he started organizing it in ways that would make use of people who were already here and people that he was recruiting. He was instrumental in recruiting a great many people. He made me the personnel director of SSRI. I never quite knew what my duties were or why he had chosen me, but he was just a very well-organized person, and he wanted to have an organization that would do various things that he wanted to do. Of course, he had this big idea of creating a model from micro data that would be different from the macro models of kind that Goldberger had worked on, but he got Goldberger because of, I'm sure, because of his experience with models and Zellner. The SSRI never developed, I think, the way he anticipated. Part of it was I think that the people he recruited didn't always have the same vision of the kind of research that he wanted to put together with a team of people that he had, and they tended to go off in their own direction, do what they wanted. I think by 1967 he was a little bit unhappy with the lack of a cohesive kind of a group that he had envisioned, I think. He also told me at one stage that he thought that he had been misled on his Brittingham professorship. He was given a Brittingham professorship when he came, funded by this newly useful money from war, and he thought it was permanent, and I guess nobody told him any differently. He told me long about 1966 that it wasn't permanent, and he had never understood that, and that it was the special funding that he had was going to cease, and that's when he left. It ceased, and he, or maybe it had already ceased in 1967, I'm not sure, but at any rate, he thought that he'd been misled on that. And by that time, of course, Edwin Young was in Maine, and maybe it may be that he raised this question with Ed, and Ed said, well, I have no influence any longer over Wisconsin. And he didn't, of course, until he came back in 1968. I guess the shell of the SSRI has continued since Guy left, but I'm not sure what it amounts to now, although I'm a poor one to ask. But my own duties as personnel director never amounted to anything at all, as far as I could tell. Part of that, I suppose, is because I became the associate chairman. But even from 1959 to 61, when I was here, I never really knew what I was supposed to do as personnel director. Well, what else can I...
But in the period that you were chair, what were the issues and the competence? You mentioned something about the two-course load.
Oh, yeah, well, I benefited a great deal as any chairman does, by the contributions that other individuals were willing to make. For instance, Goldberger was very active in the department at that time as chairman of the graduate committee. A person that has been gone for a long time but who was very influential in this department was Peter Steiner. Mm-hmm. He's one of those people who had great talent but also was able to alienate people rather easily. And it seemed to me at the time that he should have been chairman of the department, but our feeling, the feeling of a lot of people, was that he never would be chairman, that although everyone recognized his great talent, no one thought he could get enough support to be chairman. Oddly enough, of course, he went to Michigan and he became chairman of the department there. And then dean. He's now dean of their College of Arts and Letters and Science. And I don't know what the difference was, but anyway. During my period of the chairmanship, he was on a committee of the College of Letters and Science that was concerned with the credit requirements of courses, and they came up with a proposal that the course credits could be either three or four for our courses that generally met 3 days a week, 3 50-minute sessions. And that the fourth credit could be a term paper. And this was done, I think, with the idea that then departments could go to the dean and propose that people who were expected to be in the classroom 8 to 9 hours a week could have 2 8-credit courses, I mean, 2 4-credit courses, and that would be a full load, because the fourth credit would presumably require a certain amount of time to confer with students about term papers and so on, that would take the fourth credit. And so Steiner sort of ran interference for this proposal. And I don't know whether we were the first department to do it, or perhaps political science did it at the same time. They must have, because the dean was a political scientist. But I don't think history did it until sometime after we had done it. And this was considered necessary in our recruitment efforts to be able to tell people from Eastern universities that we had a 2-course load, because they had it at Yale and Harvard and MIT and places like that, where we wanted to get people. And so that was, I think, was a significant accomplishment, although I think it's probably fairly universal. I don't know, you could ask in English and in the languages, I think you'd find that they still have 3-course load in those places. Of course, we get paid more too than they do, by a substantial amount. Well, let's see, what else?
Actually, I'm just going to set the tape over.
And I think in the first year of my chairmanship, the students sat in at the A.W. Peterson building for many weeks in the spring, took over the building. And later on, early in my chairmanship, there were almost continuous meetings that went on in the large lecture room down here in the social science building, just discussing what was to be done, just interminable. And I think those meetings, however, mostly went on in the evening, so that they didn't necessarily disrupt the classes. I was a member of the university committee that year, the final year of my chairmanship. I guess I could have, if I hadn't left and gone to Singapore for a year, I probably would have been chairman of the university committee in 1968-69 year. The university committee spent all its time on these matters. There's practically nothing else on our agenda during that period, and I assume that that was the case in the few years before that, before 67-68, the year I'm talking about, and the years after that, unrest in that period. And the fact that the university committee spent practically all of its time on that, I don't think that the department affairs were affected terribly. Most of our faculty members, I think, were not activists. Some were. Ed Feige was very active in that period. I don't mean that the faculty members were disruptively active, but they were advising the students, and of course many faculty members felt very strongly about Vietnam, and so were interested in taking part in whatever students were doing, and were certainly expressing themselves in various ways, but I don't know that any faculty, there was a member of the sociology department that I guess some of us thought was rather disruptive. We didn't have any great problem internally as far as student unrest was concerned in the Department of Economics. I think that I'm not sure that I'm right, but I think that our department in the period since the 60s perhaps has taken less interest in university affairs than perhaps was the case in the earlier period. I think that partly it's our emphasis on technical matters and theory, which creates an atmosphere, I think, where faculty members tend to be to identify more with people in the discipline than they do with other people in the university. As I say, I may be completely wrong on this, but I was a member of the university committee. Jim Early had been a member of the university committee. Edwin Young had been. Bob Lampman, since then, has been a member in the 1970s, but I don't think we've had any other members of the department on the university committee. I just have a feeling that we don't take as much interest in university affairs, perhaps, as we did in an earlier period. I think that's not true as far as what is sometimes called the Wisconsin idea, or participation in state affairs and federal affairs. I think we're still very active, with the prime example, of course, our present chairman being economic advisor to the governor, but other people, Andriano, on the international level, being very active, and Haveman and Smolensky also being very active in federal kinds of activities. And I think that's always been true, that that's one of the real achievements of our department. In the earlier period, you can go back to Ed Whitty, who's always called one of the fathers of the Social Security Act, and others who participated very actively. Harold Groves, of course, is probably one of the best examples. He wrote the unemployment compensation law in Wisconsin, which was later adopted in the Social Security Act, and others have been very active and continue to be. But I do think that we have perhaps withdrawn more from university affairs in recent years from the level of participation, I think, that we had in an earlier period. I don't know what else I can say about the period of my chairmanship.
I noted a couple other things that I could go with the program in the Philippines to do.
Yeah, well, that's another thing. I think that partly it's a matter of funding, but mm-hmm. I think the department had a much greater interest in international affairs in the 50s and 60s. Of course, the Indonesian project started in 1957 at Ed Young's instigation. And then one of the things that he did was recruit Everett Hawkins. And that, I guess, is a story that I don't know whether that may be sealed in some of these other interviews that you have. But there was
a problem with that.
There was a great deal. Well, I'm not, since I didn't participate in it. I was in England and that semester. I can talk about it because it's all hearsay as far as I'm concerned. But apparently Edwin Young was able to get, I think it was $70,000 from the Ford Foundation if we would appoint Everett Hawkins as a professor. Everett Hawkins was a distinguished Indonesian scholar at Mount Holyoke at that time. And so Edwin Young proposed him. He was chairman of the department at that time, shortly before he became dean. He kind of walked away from this problem and went to the deanship. And for some reason, and the strangest alliance that I could think of, Guy Orkut and Reed Tripp opposed this. Reed Tripp had been a kind of a close colleague of Ed Young. Reed came, I think, in 1950, a labor economist, and of similar kind of interest and background as Ed Witte and Ed Young and some of the other labor people. And he could have been expected to go along with Ed Young, I think many people felt. But instead of that, he allied himself with Guy Orkut, and they decided that they were going to torpedo the Hawkins appointment. And apparently they had enough support to either the department was divided or they had a majority. I don't know. But at any rate, Hawkins was not appointed. I was in England, as I say, spring of 1961. Then Ed Young went to the deanship, and I don't know what happened, but along about 1963, the matter was brought up again, and he was appointed, and he continued with us until he died in 1970. And he was very energetic in obtaining Ford Foundation money for the Philippines project, which involved training of Philippine bureaucrats in cost-benefit analysis and things of that nature, and also in obtaining money for the Singapore project, which really was advisory kind of thing for the economics department in the University of Singapore. And I'm sure there were other things that I don't think of that Everett Hawkins did. He was very influential, at least with me as chairman, in appointing particular kinds of people. He was keenly interested in getting Kang Chow. Kang Chow was another situation where the department was divided. And there was a substantial minority who said it's all right to appoint him as assistant professor, but he doesn't have the credentials for a tenure associate professorship. This was about 1966 or 67. I remember so well the executive committee meeting where the vote was something like 15 to 12 or some such division in favor of giving him tenure, and I said, as chairman, I said, no, we're not gonna do it with that kind of a division. And we went ahead and made him an offer as assistant professor with a fairly strong promise that after 1 year we'd get him tenure, and he accepted it. But that's the kind of appointment that Everett Hawkins was particularly interested in. There were a couple others. Sam Morley was another who was appointed with Everett Hawkins' strong support. Of course, there were other factors involved. Then there's a guy named Galladay who was appointed. The department never really was enthusiastic about him, and he left after a few years and went to the, I guess he's in the World Bank. I'm trying to think who else there was that Everett Hawkins was influential in bringing here, but it was strange in the sense that he himself had not achieved a great deal of support from some members of the department, but nevertheless he was quite influential in bringing in people that he wanted to have. Then, of course, the Ford Foundation money dried up in the early 1970s. All these projects such as we had depended upon in Singapore and the Philippines and Indonesia were terminated. And so some of those people, most of them, I guess, have left. And those projects no longer exist. At that time, of course, the university was given millions of dollars for the establishment of the Office of International Studies and Programs, in which I later served as dean for some years. But the Ford Foundation changed its policy in the middle 1970s and stopped giving that money. I think that I don't know how to characterize the amount of research money that was available between the 1960s and 1970s. My impression is that it was greater in the 1960s than it partly because of the Ford Foundation international money, but of course in 1968 the Poverty Institute was established with the federal money, and along about the middle 1970s that became very uncertain and actually, I guess, disappeared for a while there in the late 1970s and early 1980s and wasn't reestablished until when? 1982. Generally, I think that there was more research money available at that time. I remember that while I was chairman, we could just about predict that at any time one-third of the FTEs would be teaching, one-third would be on research, and one... Wait a minute, how did that go? I guess one-third would be gone. I think that was it. One-third teaching, one-third research, and one-third... away. There aren't anywhere near that many people away, or the opportunities for being away, I think, are nowhere near as great as they were at that time, and so naturally you can't have as large a staff. Mm-hmm. What else?
I just had another note about the National Institute of Public Affairs and the cost-benefit.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was one of those things. I'm trying to remember how that got started. I know that I've made several trips to Washington in connection with that program, and I guess it was, there was an assistant director of what was then called the Bureau of the Budget, now called OMB, Office of Management and Budget, who is now, his name is Rowan. He is now, I think, either president or vice president of the RAND Corporation. He was very interested in PPBS, he was the promoter of PPBS in the Johnson administration. PPBS being program, you know what?
Sometimes
you must know what that is. Anyway, it's cost-benefit analysis applied to the budget.
Yeah,
planning, programming, budgeting system. I think that's it. At any rate, it was really very important part of budgeting in those days. I guess it's all but disappeared now. But people had to be trained in the various agencies in cost-benefit analysis, and so he had a program of sending people to various universities, and we were offered a certain amount of overhead money along with the people, and so we agreed to take, I don't know how many people, we had 20 degrees for a master's degree program, and it also provided some support for some of our faculty members. I think Ed Feige was the director, or I don't know what title he had, but he was the advisor of these people. I don't think the department ever had any great enthusiasm for it. It lasted maybe a year, 2 years, and it was, since it was not a research program, I guess it's natural that many people thought that it was a service activity for the federal government that they could take or leave, and they didn't think that the students were necessarily up to the level of our own graduate students. And so it just came and went over a period of a year or two in 1966 to 68. I'm sure that there's some kind of Freudian reason that I can't remember any more about it. But I think it was one of those things that where I was more enthusiastic than many members of the department were about having the program here. But partly it disappeared because I think PPBS pretty much disappeared. Not immediately, but not too long after that. Well?
You were also involved with IRRI, so.
Well, I wasn't director of that until much later. I never had a very strong association with IRRI during the period of the 50s and 60s, partly because we gave all our confidence and support to Jerry Summers, who in some ways, I think his loss is just equal to that of the loss of Orchid in a different, very different way. But he came here the same year I came. We used to call it I used to tell Steiner that it was a vintage year, that we got Summers, Steiner, and Johnson. They were two real stars, and I just happened to come along. But I would always tell Steiner that as a seniority, you know, when you have equal seniority, the alphabetical name beginning takes over, and so that I had more seniority than he did. He never would agree to that. He's still a close friend of mine, and it was in that period that, I'm not going to get into his personal life. That's something that I would want to seal. But I was in England with him in 1961 at the London School of Economics, and that was when he formed a close association with Richard Lipsey, and they decided to write a textbook. It took several years for it to develop, but by 1966, when I was chairman, that was the year he was in Greece with Roger Miller. He asked me to be the trustee for his trust fund that he was setting up from the royalties for this textbook that he was sure was going to be very successful. And I agreed to do it, and I'm still a trustee 15 years, 66. Damn. That's what is it, 19 years? Yeah, yeah. 19 years later, I'm still a trustee. The beneficiaries were his two children. One of them reaches the age where she no longer gets benefits from the trust this year. The other one, in 3 more years. So the trust will dissolve itself by its own terms in another 3 years. But during all this time, I've been handling these really have sometimes been rather substantial amounts of money, which I've invested in. For years I had to invest, and then the terms of the trust indicated that all the income had to be passed out directly to the beneficiaries. And since then I haven't had the problem of investing it, but for a long time I did. And so that was another one of the things that occurred during my chairman. I'm not sure why, well, Steiner somehow trusts me. And so we've maintained somewhat of a relationship since he left here in 1969. I'm not sure where I was before.
I just asked about IRRI.
Oh, IRRI. Well, as I say, that was a great recruiting year for getting those two people, and Steiner made great contributions to the department. Summers, contribution for the first 12 or so years he was here was largely in establishing the IRRI as a degree-granting institution. And we just kind of depended upon him. Then when I left in 1968 for a year of leave, he became chairman of the department, and from then on, of course, he had less of a relationship to the IRRI. I guess he gave it to that Stern became the director when he left. But Summers was a great contributor to this department in all kinds of ways, especially I would say in getting money. He was able to get money, I think, of a different kind from the Ford Foundation, just as well as Orchid could. He got a $1 million grant in about 1961 for this vocational rehabilitation project, and he was always able to obtain money. He and I were closely associated in the IRRA, which is different from the IRRI. The IRRA is the National Professional Organization for Industrial Relations of People. When I came here, Ed Young was the Secretary Treasurer and had been for some time, and they needed an editor. And so, as I say, Summers came the same time. He became the editor, and I could just see the wheels moving in Edwin Young's mind that he was going to shift the Secretary Treasurership over to me, which he did in 1961. So with Summers as the editor and with me as the Secretary Treasurer, we really ran that organization as it had been run from Madison for many, many years. Now the Secretary Treasurer office is still here, but it's not so closely associated with the university, since Dave Zimmerman is not a university, he's the Secretary Treasurer, not a university professor. And the newsletters, I believe, is now produced at Ohio State rather than here. But during all those years, while Jerry was alive, and he was a very important person in running the Industrial Relations Research Association. We've had many presidents, of course, of that, beginning with Ed Witte, who was the first president of it, to Edwin Young, while he was president of the University of Maine, then, of course, Jerry Summers himself, and then Jack Barbash, and then Everett Castelow, so that One might say that the University of Wisconsin has maintained its tradition in industrial relations and labor economics in a way dominating that national organization. I don't know, can't think of any I guess I was starting to say, I just can't say enough complimentary and in sorrow about Jerry Summers.
I was wondering how, I know you worked on equal opportunity programs for minorities women in the university. How do you feel the department has done
that? Well, I'm sure the whole university has not done as well as anyone interested in it would like. And our own record is probably no better. I don't know whether it's any better, any worse than the university's record. I had a really rather brief association with that program from about 1970 to 1972. The reason I was associated with it was that nobody else was doing it. There, the law was on the books and the policy of the federal government. It had been part of the responsibilities of Bob Atwell. Bob Atwell was the vice chancellor in the Fleming administration. And when Edwin Young, and also in the Sewell administration. Sewell, of course, was chancellor for only 1 year. Then when Edwin Young became chancellor, he inherited Bob Atwell, and they didn't get along very well. I knew Bob Atwell a bit because when I left Virginia, when I left Washington in 1957 to come to Madison, he bought my house. He was a function. I keep saying bureaucrat. I say bureaucrat without meaning any pejorative kind of connotation. He was a bureaucrat with the Bureau of the Budget at that time. He bought my house, and just so I maintained a little bit of contact with him. And then, strangely enough, he came out here as vice chancellor in 1963, I think. He, I think, probably, it's a matter of personality conflict. I think Edwin Young somehow isolated him, and so he resigned, and he went out to California to be a college president. But he was supposed to be doing this as affirmative action officer. And along with, I think, a lot of other things he was doing, it wasn't getting done very well because of Edwin's attitude toward him. So I had become assistant to the chancellor in spring of 1970, and that was about the time that Atwell left, and this was not being done by anybody, so I assumed a function. And it was at about this same time that, it was been the year before that the black uprising had occurred, and certain things had been done about minorities, especially blacks, in the 1969. That women started to uh, become more aggressive about their rights. And in fact, it may have been in 1970 that they amended the Civil Rights Act to include sex. I'm not sure. Or was it, maybe it was in it, or I don't know. At any rate, I think there's quite a lag, as far as women are concerned, before they really started to demand their rights. And in the spring of 1970, this doesn't have anything to do with the department, since I was across the street in the chancellor's office. I had my office in what they call the bunker. I don't think they call it the bunker anymore. The bunker is underneath the chancellor's office, down in the half underground.
Oh, the border.
And whenever the National Guard came on campus, I'd be pushed out of the office because that would be the National Guard headquarters. That's why they call it
the excitement to your days.
That's why they call it the bunker. And that happened a lot. I think the National Guard was on the campus 3 or 4 times. When I was assistant to the chancellor between spring of 1970 and the spring of 1972, I think the National Guard came twice, maybe 3 times. I know it came at the time of the Cambodian incursion. That was May of 1970. And then it came again the next year, 1971. It's still related to Vietnam. And it had been here in 1969 at the time of when blacks were creating some disruption. And I don't know whether it came a fourth time or not. But at any rate, during this same period, when Vietnam was really in the forefront of everything, the women became exercised about their rights. And established a committee of, I guess I shouldn't get into names, I wouldn't remember them all, but Serena Ponderman, of course, was one of them, and Catherine Clarenbach, and Extension was one, and the woman, I think, who is chairman of the women's program now, who's a medical faculty member, whose name at the moment I don't remember, was another, but there were others. And I remember meeting with them in the I guess it was the vice president's office over in Van Hees. Also in Edwin Young's office, and establishing a committee. Long about that time, the HEW was sending teams occasionally to the university to check on whether we were meeting the requirements that they had. And along about 1971, it was clear that, to me at least, and it was clear to a lot of other people, that we needed a better organization of this than we had. And it was at that time that Serena Ponderman was appointed as another assistant to the chancellor. She later became assistant chancellor, I think. Then when I moved over to be dean of international studies and programs, I left that office. I don't know if I'm a labor economist. I mean, my interest has been for many years in collective bargaining and labor management relations, and I'm really not the one to ask about national unemployment. Apparently this was the day that the new monthly unemployment statistics. So this was some guy from WIBA who wanted some comments. I don't think we've done as well as women would like, but I think women have probably done a hell of a lot better than blacks have done, and partly Well, mostly, I think, this is because there are more trained women around who are available for these appointments. And the great problem with affirmative action with the blacks, as far as I could see when I was in that area, was that there simply are not many trained people who can be appointed. The tendency for the people in that area from HEW and some people on our own campus is to say, look, there are all kinds of PhDs who are black. But the response that I always had, and I'm sure a lot of other people have, is, yeah, but do they come from the same sources where we do our recruiting? Are they MIT, Harvard, Yale, that kind of people that we ordinarily recruit, or are they from Tuskegee and Fisk and really not at the same level of talent? Now, I don't think that's true of women, so there's less excuse, I think, for us to not to have a good record as far as women are concerned, although there are other problems with women. I think that the problem of two careers is a very difficult one. I feel sorry for people who are married and are at different institutions. That's a hell of a way to be married, in my opinion. And one of them presumably has to make a sacrifice if they're going to live together. And so that's, I guess, just inherent in the problem as far as women are concerned and appointments of the faculty. But it's nevertheless, I think, a fact that we've not done as well as we would like to have done in appointing women. No, we hardly have any in this department. Paula and Rachel and who else?
Bobby Wolf.
Oh, Bobby Wolf. Yeah. Well, she's only part-time. Half-time.
Yeah, she's part and another.
Yeah. She was originally appointed, I think, by Preventive Medicine and came to us as probably partly an effort to swell our ranks.
Mm-hmm. I didn't have any other...
Well, I made some notes before you came in. Let me see if there's anything that I... No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Okay?
Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.